Everybody needs Bitcoin, but Bitcoin doesn't need everybody. And so there's a lot of Bitcoiners that are buying these treasury companies and they're mad at Saylor because Saylor won't post his proof of reserves.
I'm trying to bring forward the timeline on this bright orange future. And I get concerned with like playing fiat games, but it's also the reality is we live in a fiat world still.
When Bitcoin first clicked for me in 2015, it was like, oh, wow, we actually have a tool that we can win with.
Maybe there are going to be some custodial solutions where companies can more easily take something looking like self-custody versus having to trust Coinbase or what have you. I mean, we don't really know what the future holds.
It was always coming for everything. Of course, it's for you and I. It's for the hardcore freedom maximalists, the cypherpunks. But it's for businesses and it's for corporations and it's for governments. Of course, it was always coming for everybody.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Mark Moss. We cover Bitcoin treasury companies in particular, but also how the wealthy think about investing and earning money, how you can use your Bitcoin to do that. I think we agree on probably more than it seems. Certainly there's nuance to all of these things. I hear where he's coming from. I obviously have my concerns, if you've paid any attention for any period of time, to sort of perpetuating the fiat system by some of the things we discuss. But overall, Mark's an awesome guy, very smart. I think you are absolutely going to enjoy this episode. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Mark here with me. Mark, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. It's good to be here. I'm excited for the conversation. Sounds like we got a lot of good stuff to discuss.
I think so. So the hot topic of the day, Bitcoin treasury companies, as I told you offline, I think you have taken a lot more nuance to this than many people have. So you have a tweet. I told you it didn't take me long to figure out what I wanted to chat with you about. You said, I'm not going to read the whole tweet, but most people think Bitcoin treasury companies are another crypto gimmick or affinity play. But, and you go on to talk about the capital prison problem and how you've got all this capital that can't allocate to Bitcoin in self-custody, even if that were something they wanted to do. But they're stuck in all of these inferior investment vehicles effectively is kind of maybe a simple way of framing it. Could you explain what you think the role of these treasury companies are, why they're useful, and maybe where that utility stops if you see it, you know, stopping at some point?
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing I would say is that people have these preconceived notions or expectations in their head. And when assets or things or people don't live up to those, then they take a strong stance again, they get disappointed. I thought my wife was supposed to cook and clean all the time. She doesn't. Now I'm mad at her, right? I thought Bitcoin was supposed to be a medium of exchange, but is only being used as a store of value, so it's failed. And so we take people, things, circumstances, and we try to put them in these boxes. That's just not how the world works. So again, right, there's this massive debate that Bitcoin's failed. It's not a medium of exchange. It's only a store of value. Okay, well, what if it's both? Maybe it just hasn't become that yet. So let's go back to the question at hand, the Bitcoin treasury strategy, companies and what's going on. Well, does it fit into your preconceived notion of what you think Bitcoin is, Bitcoin should be, or what Bitcoin will become? Now, I am a hardcore freedom maximalist. I have been before I came to Bitcoin, which is why Bitcoin appealed to me. So the ability, and when I first when Bitcoin first clicked for me in 2015, it was like, oh, wow, we actually have a tool that we can win with. This is actually something that we can take the power back. We can change the world. I got to tell the whole world about it, and I've never stopped talking about Bitcoin since. That's why I came to Bitcoin. But we have to understand that Bitcoin is bigger. It was always coming for everything. Of course, it's for you and I. It's for the hardcore freedom maximalists, the cypherpunks. But it's for businesses and it's for corporations and it's for governments and it's for every, of course it was always coming for everybody. And it's going to change the entire world. So back to the Bitcoin treasury companies, the matter at hand. First of all, I would say it's a one-way street. Everybody needs Bitcoin, but Bitcoin doesn't need everybody. The corporations need Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't need corporations. The governments need Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't need the governments. But the treasury company, so MicroStrategy started this, right? Saylor's told the story 1,000 times. I'm sure your listeners have heard it. I don't need to go retell it. But the high level thing is here he was in 2020 sitting on $500 million, a half a billion dollars of cash. It's a melting ice cube. What do I do with it? Now, this isn't a problem that's unique to Sailor. This is a problem that every single business faces today. As a matter of fact, I also tweeted, if you're scrolling through my tweets recently, I don't tweet that often, or post on X, I guess it is, about Jamie Dimon talking about buying back their stock. Okay, so every business, like Sailor, has this problem. We have all this cash and we don't know what to do with it. Now, the average person doesn't understand this. They've never worked in a Fortune 500 environment before. I, early in my career, built a tech business and sold it to a Fortune 500 company, so I got a little bit of insight into that. So these businesses have this money like Sailor. What do I do with it? Well, Sailor's gone through the things. Well, I could reinvest it into my business, but my business isn't really going to grow. It's not the best place to put the capital. I could buy some other companies, but that introduces risk and operational risk, and I don't know about how to run those companies. I can continue to hold it in treasuries, but that's losing to the rate of debasement. What do I do? So he decided to move into Bitcoin. And since then, there was MicroStrategy, that was 1.0, and now there's Strategy 2.0. Okay, now obviously, like I said, all these corporations today have this problem. And what they do, if we think of money as energy, they're all leaking or bleeding their energy. They don't know what to do with it, which makes these companies worth less and less and less and less over time. So MicroStrategy 1.0 was about really saving the company by going onto a Bitcoin standard. Just like you and I would save our own savings, our own future, by going onto a Bitcoin standard, right? Because no matter what you invest into, there's only been two asset classes that are keeping up with the rate of monetary debasement, the NASDAQ and Bitcoin. That's it. Anything else you're putting your money into, Ray Dalio's all-weather portfolio, has been averaging a 7.7% return. That's losing to the rate of debasement. So it's the same problem. And what he did is he moved the treasury into Bitcoin and obviously turned the company around. Okay. But then Metaplanet was the first company to come out and successfully duplicate the model. And this is where things start to get interesting. So what Metaplanet did is they launched in Japan. Now, Japan and France and Brazil and Turkey and the UK all have different financial systems than the US does. And what Metaplanet did is took a product, a Bitcoin product, to a market like Japan that has lots of money trapped in TradFi, traditional financial markets, that are stuck behind mandates and have no ability to get into an asset like Bitcoin that could help them also save their future savings. And so Metaplanet created a company that's listed in the Japanese public markets and now allows trillions of dollars stuck in TradFi, the ability to get off of the sinking ship and get into a lifeboat that's backed by Bitcoin. Now, since then, we've had dozens of these companies pop up and do the same thing. Now, look, are all of them on the same mission? I don't know. I haven't sat down with every single founder. I can tell you I've talked to dozens of them. My fund, the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, we invest into most of these deals early round before they go public. So I have seen a front row seat to many of these. And overall, what the winning strategy is, I don't know what, you know, however many of this is going to be if they're going to do the right thing. But what the game plan is for me and what I was trying to say in this tweet, and there was a follow-up tweet where I said it's not for Bitcoiners. I don't know if you saw that tweet. It's not for Bitcoiners. It is not for people that want to hold Bitcoin in cold storage. It's no replacement for that. And so there's a lot of Bitcoiners that are buying these treasury companies and they're mad at Sailor because Sailor won't post his proof of reserves. I think it's a ridiculous argument. You're not buying proof. There's no proof of reserves. You don't have custody of anything. You're buying an equity. There's counterparty risk. So it's no replacement for Bitcoin holders that want to hold Bitcoin in self-custody. But most Bitcoiners don't really understand that these issues are complex. So when you have $1,000 to your name and you're, 27 years old, YOLO, man, go all in on Bitcoin for sure. When you have millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, the situations are different. I've been to Sailor's house. He has multiple houses. At his house in Miami that I've been to, he's got three yachts out there. You own other things besides just Bitcoin. And so what happens is the TradFi world is really big. The sad fact is that the majority of people don't want to learn anything about money. They don't want to learn anything about managing money. And so most people have their money being invested by advisors or fund managers or 401k administrators or whatever that is, right? And those so there's about 300 trillion stuck in the fixed income market. 300 trillion stuck in fixed income. There's about another 180 stuck in equities. So we're talking about $500 trillion of money that people have parked that's being managed. And each one of those dollars is in some sort of a vehicle, a pension fund or some credit fund or something like that. And each one of those have their own mandates. And those mandates don't let them buy Bitcoin. And look, I'm all for like education, which is, of course, on my YouTube channel. I've got over 100 million views trying to educate people on why they should buy Bitcoin. Dump that stuff and buy Bitcoin. But the fact is, most people aren't, won't. I think they all should, but they won't. And so they have this money that's being invested and it's losing money. So now what Saylor has done, Strategy 2.0, is he's now creating financial products, Strike, Strife, Stride. Each one of these products is being purpose-built to fit into the mandates of each one of these capital pools. So now you have $500 trillion in all these pools of liquidity all around the world. People are trapped in them. Their fund administrators are trapped. The way Wall Street works, TradFi works, is they play not to lose. They don't play to win. So all of these fund administrators, plan administrators, they don't want to lose their job. They're not trying to outperform. They don't need to outperform. All they need to do is meet the benchmark, right? So all of a sudden, they're not looking for new things. So all of a sudden, Strike, Strife, Stride, or whatever the new product is in whatever jurisdiction they're in, all of a sudden, there's a new product that allows them to move into that. So for example, a lot of these funds in the fixed income market, it's the biggest market in the world, they're typically buying, debt instruments, credit instruments, right? And so what they do, if you've seen The Big Short in like 2008, they take all these debt instruments and they put them all together like sausage in a CDO. And then then people invest into them, but they have no idea to know what's even in that. It's a tranche that's just all put together. I don't know what's in there. So it's opaque. Because of that, I don't know what my risk level is. So I'm taking crazy high risk, even though I think it's safe. And it's under collateralized to the amount that's being lent against it. It's a terrible high risk investment, and I'm earning 3-5%, which is about half of the rate of monetary debasement. Now, all of a sudden, Saylor's coming in, creating a product that's pristine collateral, and not under collateralized, but over collateralized, and not paying half the rate of debasement, paying more than the rate of debasement. And now, tens of millions of people around the world that have money in these accounts who have no hope, man, their money's stuck in a sinking ship and they're losing. All of a sudden, those fund administrators can get into these treasury companies and save those people without them even needing to know. And look, it's not a replacement for owning Bitcoin and cold storage, but the majority of those masses won't do it. And in my opinion, that is a massive, massive service to those people. It's huge value, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, so I think everything you said makes sense. So let me give you very, very briefly my position. Feel free to correct my course if you think I deviate somewhere. So I agree with you, like that there's all this capital that can't go into Bitcoin, even if you had the most hardcore Bitcoin maxi running a pension fund or what have you, right? They just can't do it in many jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And so there's why not take the next best option to Bitcoin and cold storage? And I agree with you. Companies like Strategy are doing that. I think where I have a hard time is that it seems like many people who have been in Bitcoin long enough to me who should know better, or certainly many new people coming into Bitcoin who are trying to sort this out, are seeing this, and it's being marketed, it feels to me, like to retail investors as well as to pension funds. And if you've got a retirement account, I totally get it. You can't hold Bitcoin in cold storage there, perhaps. What I fear is that people who think that they're doing something, some sort of Bitcoin play, who don't understand 6102 attacks, regulatory risk, management risk, data breach risk, all of these factors that go into any fiat product, especially when you're, you know, two derivatives away is the custodian. They're not showing proof of reserves, that sort of thing. I mean, it's a private contract. If Michael Saylor doesn't want to show proof of reserves, I think it'd be a cool thing for him to do. But like, he doesn't have to. You invest knowing that he's not showing you proof of reserves. That maybe it's a disservice to people trying to figure this Bitcoin thing out, and they think when they buy MSTR or they think that they're, you know, buying these debt products or what have you, that they're in some way allocating or exposing themselves to Bitcoin, like self-sovereign Bitcoin versus number go up Bitcoin, which I just sort of distinguish. Is that a fair take, or am I missing anything material there?
I think maybe there's quite a bit of that's being missed there. So let's go back and think through some of the terminology that you threw out there, right? So number one, you talked about like some Bitcoiners, old school, big name Bitcoiners that are sort of getting behind this, and are they misleading people? So the only guy named in the Bitcoin white paper, Adam Back, is all about these Bitcoin treasury companies. He's in like most of the big deals right now. So this isn't like, I'm a hardcore cypherpunk Bitcoiner, I don't like that. No, he sees the value of getting all of these people in sinking ships into Bitcoin. Let's get to the second point, though. You said, I think is what you said is, it's being marketed to retail Bitcoin investors in a certain light, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's think of, so Bitcoin retail investors. Investors being the key word that you said there.
Yeah.
So investors are people who are taking the money they've earned and they're trying to grow it, right? And so as investors, unfortunately, the fiat system makes us be investors because our money loses value.
Right.
Investors are looking for putting their money to where it's treated best, right? Where it's going to grow the most. They're trying to beat the rate of debasement and then some, hopefully, right? Mm-hmm. Now, typically, investors have been taught not to put everything into one stock and to diversify things, right? So typically, would you say investors typically own more than one asset?
Certainly.
Right. Do you think that the more money that you have, the more interested you are in owning different assets?
I would think so.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to own different assets. And I don't advise owning 20 or 30 assets. I think 3 or 4, 5 is pretty good. Warren Buffett says diversification is sort of like a sign of ignorance. So really, you need to hone in on a couple assets that work really well for you. Okay, so we kind of agree that investors would typically want to invest into some different types of assets. And we would typically do that based off of like risk and reward, right? So we know the safer stuff isn't going to go up as much. And then we go for a little bit of other stuff that's a little bit more risky, but has higher return. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to distinguish, Mark, though, I guess if I did use the word investor, I think I would distinguish between people who are seeking to take on risk in order to optimize returns in way to do that cost benefit analysis versus people who understand sort of, you know, the quote unquote Bitcoin ethos and are seeking self-sovereignty,
right,
and are potentially, in my view, and I could be wrong, but to some degree being sort of duped is the wrong word, but being convinced that that self-sovereign Bitcoin and buying MSTR are somehow, it's sort of like a one for one, you know, I'll do a little bit of both or what have you. When one is a speculative investment and one to me is a very reliable form of savings.
Sure.
So I'll just add that.
Okay. So hear the word you just said, a reliable form of savings. And the reason why I'm trying to hone in on those words is first you said retail investor, now you said reliable form of savings. The reason why I just hone in on those two words is
Makes a difference.
I look at Bitcoin as savings. Mm-hmm. So when I think of my money and how I distribute my money, what I put into real estate and what I put into Bitcoin, I consider that savings, not investment. That makes sense?
That makes sense.
But I also invest and I put dollars into other places where I think it could even outperform Bitcoin. Now, the word is being thrown around quite often, the hurdle rate. The hurdle rate is basically if I borrow money to buy a capital asset, buy equipment for my business, my hurdle rate is the cost of that capital, right? But we're kind of using it today in terms of Bitcoin is averaging a 50 to 60% CAGR. So that's my hurdle rate. If I can't make more than 50 or 60%, I ain't interested because my savings is growing at 50 or 60%, right?
Yep.
But I also take some money that I think can grow at more than 50 or 60%, and I invest that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I agree with you. Look, we're hardcore Bitcoiners. We both agree on this. The majority of my wealth, and I think the majority of most people's wealth, should be in savings in Bitcoin cold mm-hmm. storage. Although, you know, what is the majority of wealth, right? I mean, for someone, you know, for a mid-career professional that's, you know, making six figures, making 100, 150 grand, has got a couple kids, what percentage of their wealth would you tell them they should invest into Bitcoin?
Like, realistically. I don't feel qualified to make that determination.
Right.
For
so I would typically
but
say,
I would say a lot for myself, right?
I would say, you know, at least 5% or 10%. For me, it's like 50 or 60%, right? Ricardo Salinas, the third richest guy in Mexico, says 75%. And so anyway, you can kind of figure out where you need to be in there. But so hardcore, certainly we want to put it into the savings in saving Bitcoin, self-custodied. And then some of it I invest. So I have a fund, the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, I'm a partner in, and we're on a Bitcoin standard, but we're investing into Bitcoin companies, now a lot of the treasury companies, because they're beating Bitcoin returns. So, you know, Strategy, Metaplanet, Smarter Web Company, you know, we can go on and on and on. They are beating Bitcoin returns. They are doing that. So if you're investing for dollars, trying to gain more dollars, it's a different game than saving in Bitcoin. And I think that's kind of the point I'd make. Now, to the point that you think that people are being duped into it, I would say if somebody's mistaking buying Bitcoin in self-custody for MicroStrategy, thinking it's the same thing, they should probably do a little bit more research. Obviously, owning an equity is not the same as owning Bitcoin in cold storage. So I don't know if I would say they're being duped. What I would ask you, because you obviously have a podcast and you know you're talking to people, and the big question always is like, how do we orange pill more people, right? What do you see, or what do you think is the main reason the majority of people come into Bitcoin for the first time?
I mean, number go up.
Because all trying to save our savings, right? So we come for number go up. And so really what people are looking for is the best place to put money, a risk-adjusted way to get your number to go up. And so Bitcoin is the best performing asset in history. So naturally people come to that. But these treasury companies, they're outperforming. They just are. And so if people are just coming to Bitcoin for number, I have a tweet that went pretty viral years ago. It's been used a lot. People come for the NGU, but they stay for the freedom because Bitcoin changes us, right? But for people that are just coming for NGU and they haven't learned about the freedom side of things yet, you know, the treasury companies look attractive.
Yeah. How do you evaluate though? That makes sense. Like it's really, if you think MicroStrategy is going to outperform that hurdle rate and you want to take, you know, 60% of your wealth, you're going to save and 40%, you're going to invest in some capacity. You might look at, you know, MicroStrategy, for example, or you might start a business, right? Like there are many ways that you can invest that money in the hopes of bigger returns, and you're taking on more risk depending on sort of the approach you take. How do you think about, like, is there capacity for unlimited numbers of treasury companies to be successful? Or do you think this market's going to sort of go to a handful, like, you know, to Metaplanet, MicroStrategy, the first movers?
Yep.
If Apple suddenly, you know, gets in on the game, and they obviously have billions in capital to do something like this. Do you have like a longer term risk profile of, say, MicroStrategy is very far ahead. So to the extent that the strategy works long term, they seem likely to win, right? Like probably a safer sort of investment relative to a UK-based web design company coming into the game who's performed well so far, but like, are they going to be around in 10 years or what have you? How do you think about that?
Yeah. So the way that I want to answer that question, because it's a really good question, I want to go back and just make one point before we jump into that, because, you know, basically you're asking sort of like for the future. And so if we think into the future, what a lot of like hardcore sovereign Bitcoiners that believe in everybody putting Bitcoin into cold storage maybe haven't really considered is that Satoshi created actually, obviously the most scarce asset, only 21 million Bitcoin, but he actually created two scarcities. So number one he created was only 21 million coins, scarcity number one. But scarcity number two is the block size.
Mm-hmm.
So we can only get about 400,000 transactions done on the base layer. There's 8.5 billion people in this world.
Yeah. Well, so it doesn't scale to 8 billion people.
So what happens is, using, you know, a bunch of technology and AI, and we can figure out how to get the UTXOs to match up and batch in and out, and maybe we triple that. You know, we get to 1.2, maybe we get to 2 million, but still it's nowhere near the 8 billion, right? And so the unfortunate reality is that in the future, and maybe this is 50 years or 60 years from now, I don't know, but the majority of people will never have Bitcoin in cold storage and transact on the base layer. They just won't.
Mm-hmm.
So even a hardcore maximalist like myself or you who have it on the base layer may not even be able to do that. Because let's say, you know, we get to that point in 50 years where we brought on, I believe, talking about the future, I believe around 2050, 2055 is when Bitcoin becomes a unit of account. And that's when we'll bring in the masses. And even a hardcore Bitcoin like myself, that I may not be able to transact on the base layer. It's just going to be too expensive. So, you know, while we have this kind of take right now, are these Bitcoin treasuries good or not? Maybe the sad fact is that in the future, a lot of people probably won't have Bitcoin in cold storage. And even if we did, we wouldn't really transact because the fees would be so high. And we also have to just kind of take into consideration that, you know, the majority of people, unfortunately, I don't love this. This is why I'm an educator. The majority of people, they don't want to spend any time to learn about money or ways to grow it and manage it. And they don't want to learn about self-custody, and it's terrible. But that's just the sad fact of the way the world is. And so anyway, I wanted to put that out there. Okay,
yeah.
Going back to the question of how many of these companies could we have? Well, sort of, I kind of made the case of what they're really doing, right? So what they're really doing is creating a new financial product, like a straw. I put that out on Twitter. I made an image for it. Like a straw that taps into these liquidity pools, right? And each one's like a little bit different, right? So everyone is like a little bit of a different company doing a little bit of a different thing, and Sailor's making like individual different products. And so each one's like a little bit different, right? How many financial products do we have today? Tens of thousands? How many ETFs do we have? Thousands. So how many of these could we have? Well, I guess thousands. I guess tens of thousands, right? I mean, that's how many financial products we have today. So when I look at them as like individual unique products that compete, and companies, like, I mean, we can have thousands, right? In the shorter time frame, the way I look at it, and this is the way it's going, right? Like, MicroStrategy works in the U.S. markets, or Strategy works in the U.S. markets. Metaplanet works in the Japanese markets. Now, I was in Prague speaking. I did a keynote in Prague 2 weeks ago. I got to go have a little private dinner with Michael Saylor and Adam Back and Alexander from the Blockchain Group. We had a nice little dinner. And Sailor's moving into Europe. So he's going to go start tapping into some of the Europe markets. But you have all these markets that are under their own regulatory moats. And so, you know, Nakamoto, David Bailey's company, has talked about wanting to open one up in every jurisdiction, right? So they're working on that right now. So there's a big one that's about to pop in Brazil right now. You know, there's Smarter Web in the UK, but they're on like the Aquas exchange. It's real small. There's a big LSE one that's just about to pop. It's called Satsuma. That's another UTXO one. So there's ones in all these jurisdictions. Canada, obviously, Matador's one in Canada. So there's all these ones in different jurisdictions. And so we'll probably get several in each jurisdiction, you know, to start. And then depending on, you know, how creative they can be with their products, again, like the market can bear thousands of financial products.
And so it's really just a matter in your mind of them finding those sort of niche use cases that people, you know, like Japan and the US are like two obvious big, but even within Japan, there are probably subsets of individuals, corporations who need different access.
So just in Japan alone, there's $7 trillion in fixed income waiting to get sucked out. $7 trillion, just in Japan alone. In the UK, which is another market, which is sort of the old financial hub of the world, but still is pretty big. They have the highest fixed income to equity ratio market in the world. Trillions and tens of trillions of dollars stuck, just ready to get sucked out. You know, I think we both would agree that eventually Bitcoin, you know, becomes the base layer of the financial world. I think we both would agree that, right? I mean, that's what I believe anyway. And like I said, I kind of think that happens after about 2050, 2055, it becomes a unit of account. And so we're talking, again, about $500 trillion. How many companies is it going to take to suck all that liquidity up, right? A lot.
Yeah. And so a lot of it will come down to management execution, how they pursue, you know, custody, how safely they do that. Probably to some degree, I would imagine, whether you think Saylor should or shouldn't share the private keys or the public keys or the addresses, it's like that might be a differentiator for some companies to say, look, here we have proof of reserves. Or maybe there are going to be some custodial solutions where companies can more easily take something looking like self-custody versus having to trust Coinbase or what have you. I mean, we don't really know what the future holds.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of risk here. I mean, like, to your point, right? Like, these are all going to be individual companies, and companies fail all the time. And the very nature of this business is to take leverage, the very nature of it, right? So you're trying to lever up the Bitcoin on the balance sheet, right? That's the very nature. And then we know that human nature, on top of that, pushes things too far. So the fact that the nature of the business is to use leverage, and then we put human nature on top of that, we know there's going to be lots of people that take it too far. And there's going to be scammers, right? There's going to be scammers that come in, and we're going to see all of that. And so where the risk is in the equity, right? So I buy a company at 6x MNAV or 8x MNAV, and it drops, the equity price drops down to a 1, you know, or 2. So I lose a lot of money on the equity side. And that's going to happen, you know, for sure.
Yeah. And that's so maybe it's unfair. I probably tend to jump to the word speculation when at times what prudent investors at least are doing is investing. And you could always argue any investment is a speculation on the future, but like there's sort of a distinction as to the, you know, like when I say speculation, I think most people would imagine that to be, well, you're just kind of guessing, you know, like that's what financial advisors think I'm doing with Bitcoin. Right. An investor could make a prudent decision. They might be wrong and they might pay the price for being wrong, but that's just been the nature of anything since the beginning of time.
Do you want me to walk you through the math of how you value these?
Yeah. If you think that'd be an interesting exercise.
Because I think what you just said there is speculative is sort of like guessing, but you kind of define everything's speculative. You're right. Like the Warren Buffett term of investment is different, right? So everything is sort of speculative to your point, but if we can sort of come up with a math equation for it, it's not as speculative, right? Yeah. So there is a math equation, right? So basically these companies and you know, what I'm seeing here, you know, I started buying Bitcoin in 2015, as I told you. I'm a super freedom maximalist. I got to tell the whole world about it. I fell down the crypto rabbit hole. 2016 to 2019, I wrote a cryptocurrency research newsletter, and I was recommending every cryptocurrency out there. I admit it. You know, people try to shame me on X. I'm like, man, I admit it all the time. After I published 1,000 pages of research, I'm like, nope, none of this is it. It's only Bitcoin. So I didn't come to Bitcoin from a Bitcoin-only stance from a place of ignorance. I actually came to it from a place of research. But what we're seeing is very similar to like the 2017 ICO boom, right? But the difference is these are actually real companies with real founders, and they're being registered on real exchanges, and they're buying Bitcoin on the balance sheet. So that's really the key thing, is they're buying the Bitcoin. So there's a few metrics that we have to sort of know. And if you're looking at, you know, TradFi metrics, you don't understand these. So number one is the MNAV. That's the multiple to the net asset valuation or the Bitcoin they have. So these things should always trade more than a 1x MNAV because they're using leverage. So probably a 2 to 2.5 is somewhere around like a fair market value for a pretty good, well-executing company. But some of them, like Metaplanet, runs up to like a 6x, or Smarter Web Company runs up to like a 10x. So why are they trading at a 10x or a 6x or MicroStrategy's at a 2 or 2.5? It's because of how fast they're adding the Bitcoin to their balance sheet, or the yield, as it's called. So Metaplanet's doing about 1% a day. That's how quickly it's adding Bitcoin to the balance sheet. Because what markets are forward-looking. Markets are discounting mechanisms. So when you buy a traditional company, a TradFi company, an Apple, a Tesla, Google, you're basically buying discounted cash flows. I think that Apple will sell more iPhones in the future. They're going to maintain their profit margins. They're going to return this much, you know, profit. And so I'm buying discounted future cash flows, right? What you're doing when you're buying the Bitcoin treasury company is you're buying discounted future Bitcoin. So I'm willing to pay a higher multiple because they're adding Bitcoin so quickly they can cover, that's the days to cover. They'll cover that, Adam back came up with that metric. They can cover that in 68 days, even though it's a high multiple, like Metaplanet's a 5 or 6 times multiple, but it can cover in 68 days, whereas MicroStrategy's 2.5, but it's going to take them 111 days to cover. Because I'm buying future discounted Bitcoin. Right.
So you're rewarded for velocity to some degree.
I mean, it's trying to kind of compare it to TradFi. If Apple announced that, you know, they opened up this new market and they think their sales of their iPhones are going to grow by 30% next quarter, and they did this new automation where they're going to bring profitability, you know, profit margins down, then the stock would trade up because we're trying to buy into that future. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's what these companies are doing. So like Metaplanet, so MicroStrategy released their plan. It was a 21 plan, 21 billion. They surpassed that. Now it's a 42 plan. Metaplanet has a 555 plan. So their goal is to get to 210,000 Bitcoin by 2027. They're adding 1% per day. That's their yield, right? So each of these companies then forecasts, you know, how much Bitcoin they're going to have. And I want to buy that company today knowing. So here's what I think of as an investor. So Metaplanet, if they have 210,000 Bitcoin by 2027, how much do I think Bitcoin will be worth? I think it'll be worth $600,000-$700,000 in 2027. Okay, so now $600,000 per Bitcoin times 210,000 Bitcoin at a fair market value of, say, a 2x MNAV. Now what's the company worth? Holy freaking cow, I better buy that stock. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I am.
So it's obviously operational risk. Can they really get to that much Bitcoin? Can Apple deliver the iPhones? Is, you know, China shutting down their factories? They're moving over to India. Is that going to go smooth? I don't know. So there's operational risk. These are businesses. But if they get to 210,000 Bitcoin by 2027, and I think Bitcoin's worth, say, $500,000, and they're trading at just a 2x MNAV, they're going to be worth a lot of money, and I can buy it for super cheap today.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, no, that's an interesting way of framing it. And I guess what I would just say to anyone listening is when you're a very experienced investor and you've done the research, you're looking deeply into this, you can explain all of these concepts very well. And I guess my concern is that probably the average person can't, right?
Sure. And they shouldn't be buying things they don't understand.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe most people don't understand. They understand counterparty risk because it's ingrained in what we do, right? You trust the bank, you trust your doctor, you trust your whoever. Like you just assume that everyone's got your best interest in mind, or at least you have to operate under that assumption to navigate in the fiat world. So just, you know, buyer beware, make sure you understand what you're investing in. It makes you understand that distinction that Mark talked about between savings and investing, two very, very different things, very different calculations that go into it.
What I always like to say in regards to that is I always say the risk is in the investor, not the investment. So if you don't understand what you're buying and what you expect from it and where it's going and what time frame, you're taking on way too much risk. It's too risky. So for example, I could tell you, you know, top five treasury plays I'm looking at, but that'd be too risky for you to buy them because you don't understand the metrics, right? It'd be like, you know, you live in St. Louis, Missouri. Oh, sorry, not to dox you.
All good. All good.
That's okay. I said it. You live in Missouri. I'm a surfer. I'm in Southern California. If you said, Mark, you know, I've always wanted to try surfing. What's the best wave for me to surf? I'd be like, oh, pipeline in Hawaii. You should go, you know, that's the best wave. But you should certainly not go surf out there. You'll drown in a second. It's like 30-foot waves breaking over shallow reef. You'll die, right? But then you're like, but I see 100 guys out there every day. They're not drowning because they built up the skill to that. So that's what I mean by the risk is in the investor, not the investment. And to your point, yes, of course, extreme caution. Make sure you put the reps in. Make sure you do your proof of work and understand anything before you buy anything.
Yeah, definitely. So we could talk about that subject all day long. I do want to shift because you mentioned before we hit record the question, how much Bitcoin does it take to retire? There are probably a couple of ways we can take this, but how about just answer the question without any other context? How much Bitcoin does it take to retire? How do you think about answering that question?
So on Twitter, we like to put things out with no nuance, so people fight over it in the comments. Here we are, we're long form, so we can talk about the nuance here. So first of all, retirement's a scam that was sold to you by fiat. The goal is not to have this life of leisure where you do nothing and sit Mai Tais all day. That's a terrible life, in my opinion. We're Bitcoiners. We're about proof of work, right? Do something, put value into the world. But it's really more about not freedom from work, but freedom to work on things you want to do. So how much money would I need to have to meet Mai base needs to allow me to do that? And that number is going to vary. Obviously, you in Missouri, it's way, way cheaper than it is for me here in Southern California, or cheaper than Mai friends in Colombia. It's even cheaper for them. So it comes down to how much you need. But let's try to put some numbers to this. So I actually have a free book that you can download with a free calculator that can calculate this out. And I built a product that actually does it. It's called a perpetual income Bitcoin annuity. So what happens is people think in TradFi world, so I'm supposed to get a good job, save for retirement. One day I have enough savings where I could quit, do nothing, and live off Mai savings, right? And then hopefully I die before I run out of money, which is like terrible. So you leave nothing for the world. Horrible. But in Bitcoin, we think of the same way. So how much would I need to have saved for me to then live off of the savings? So I don't know. If I want to retire at 30, and I want to live in Southern California, I need way more than if I retire at 80 and I live in Colombia. So like the numbers are all over the board. So what I think, well, it's not what I think. The way the wealthy build wealth is different, right? The wealthy, the poor and the middle class, they work to earn money, and the money is to pay their bills. And so the whole way they view work and the whole relationship around work and money is transactional to pay their bills. And the way they use credit is to buy things they can't afford. I want the bigger house, the bigger car, go on vacation, whatever. The wealthy do it completely different. What the wealthy do is they work to earn money to buy assets. And they use the assets to pay for their life. Not the work pays for the life, the assets do. And the way they use credit is they use credit not because they don't have the money, because it's cheaper to use someone else's money than their own. So I have to say that first, because when I tell you the strategy, everyone's like, but isn't that too risky? Yeah, because you think like a poor person where you don't have the money for credit. Okay, so the goal is to work and earn money and buy assets, not sell assets for money. Like Mai grandfathers and Mai friends' grandfathers, they knew this. And so like Mai grandfather, he bought as much land and buildings and stuff as he could. Recently, a few months ago, Mai friend's grandfather died. Multiple beach houses, house in the mountains, industrial buildings, all this stuff. And the kids now, they're trying to sell it all, right? But that's the fiat system that we're in today.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is we buy assets and we never sell them, because the assets are wealth. So your sailor talked about this, you know, never sell it, right, Laura? Never sell. So we want to buy the Bitcoin. And then what do? How do we get money from it? Well, we leverage it with debt. And most people, but that's risky. Yeah, because you think like that you can't afford the debt. So I want to build the Bitcoin and then I leverage it with debt. Now we have an asset that's going up by about 60% a year, CAGR. A lot of people tend to think that's going to trend down. That's Mai base case. Sailor says, you know, maybe it trends down to about 25% in 20 years or 30 years. So as long as the asset is growing faster than the debt that I put on top of it, I can do that in perpetuity. So here's the math. First, how much income do you need per month to take care of your living expenses? Is it 10 grand a month? 6,000 a month? 20,000 a month? Number one. So I have a calculator. You go and put, how much do you need per year? $100,000. Okay, cool. All right. If you had $100,000 and you have one Bitcoin today and you're willing to wait 5 years, you could get the $100,000 in perpetuity forever, tax-free.
You're basing that on like a 50% CAGR. Like you're going to...
I have all this math. I gave the keynote, the closing keynote at Bitcoin MENA in Abu Dhabi in December. And I broke down, in the keynote, I broke down the math of how much money the government's printing, how much assets, all assets will go up in value, where I think Bitcoin is through 2030, 2040, and 2050. So I think it will maintain a 50% through 2030, right? which means it's worth $1 million in 2030.
Okay.
So I have one Bitcoin worth $100,000 today. In 5 years, it's worth $1 million. I borrow 10%, very low risk. I borrow 10% against that. That's $100,000. That is not taxable because it's debt. It's not profit. I can spend that money. The next year, I can borrow against it again, and I can borrow against it again, and I can just keep rolling the debt over. I don't have the calculator in front of me, but let's say that like over 20 years, I end up with $8 million of debt against $50 million of Bitcoin or something like that, right?
Right, right, right.
But, and so then people are like, but when do I pay the debt? It's like, why would you pay the debt? Because we want to hold the asset because the asset is growing at multiples of what the debt is.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, to what extent are you thinking about the assets producing cash flow? So for example, you know, commercial office building, industrial office building, something like that, where you've got tenants, you've got, you know, there's some sort of utility to it that accrues value, that you are able to pay the debt as you continue, remove that leverage to the extent that you want to. Is that sort of, because this sounds a lot like Robert Kiyosaki, right? Like Rich Dad, Poor Dad. How do you think about like the assets that people should be pursuing?
Yeah,
it could be a lot of things.
It is exactly a strategy that Robert Kiyosaki would do. And that's how the wealthy 1% do it. Because the wealthy realize, number one, taxes is your single biggest expense. So if I can cut out my single biggest expense, and I can grow my assets faster, I can get ahead faster. So I don't want to pay tax. So I use debt, which is non-taxable. And then I keep the asset because the asset's going up faster than the debt. So let's talk about the cash flow piece. So you talk about like a building, like a warehouse or something like that, right? At the end of the day, what is cash flow? So if I own a building, I buy a building for $1 million, I put $200,000 down, it gives me a 10% cash on cash return. I'm making $20,000 a year of cash flow. But let's say that I own that building for 3 years. I bought it for $1 million. I sell it for $3 million. Is that cash flow?
Yeah. One time, very large cash flow. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So what we're doing with Bitcoin is we're harvesting the appreciation as cash flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah.
People, again, remember the very first thing I started out this conversation with is people have these like preconceived notions of what things are supposed to be and how they work. And so I'm here to shatter all of that. If we think of things more broadly, like down to like a first principles level, we can start to see the world differently and we can start to make our own decisions based off of that. So there's a bunch of ways to get cash flow from something. I could buy a building, rent it out. I could buy a building, sell it for a year later for twice as much. I could buy a building and every year pull a little bit of the appreciation off with debt. Either way, it gives me cash flow, right? So we can do the same thing with Bitcoin. Certainly, we could rent our Bitcoin out. I don't advise that to anybody. You know, rehypothecate it. That's what like, you know, BlockFi Celsius did. I don't advise that. That's number one. And a lot of people think they should do that. I should earn 7 or 8% yield on my Bitcoin by loaning it out, right?
Yeah.
That's terrible.
A lot of risk.
I agree. I'm not going to risk 100% to make 7%. I don't like that deal. But what I could do, since it's going up at 50% a year, is I could harvest 10% of that per year tax free,
mm-hmm.
and that's cash flow.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of framing it. So I'll tell you, and so this is where I appreciate this conversation a lot because. As a hardcore Bitcoin maxi who's trying to bring forward the timeline on this bright orange future, and I get concerned with like playing fiat games, but it's also the reality is we live in a fiat world still. I think maybe the nuance that you're bringing me is like, for example, Strike's recent loan product that they started offering. Where I immediately go with that is, a lot of people are going to get wrecked because they can't do the risk management. They don't understand the custodial, the managerial, what a margin call is, right? They can't predict what the volatility of the price of Bitcoin is going to be, all of these. And to your point, just like a very, very important but subtle one is, how much are you putting up to begin with? Because it's one thing if you've got a Bitcoin to put one Bitcoin up and take out a loan against it. It's another thing to take a small percentage of that stack. And if you're willing to wait for that value to appreciate, then you can take a small percentage of your stack, but it's actually a meaningful amount 5 years from now, to your point.
And notice I said 10%.
10%?
I said 10, you know, borrow 10%. I think that's a low risk, reasonable number, right?
Yeah, but. Yeah. And so, you know, the only, like, and this is for me, like a little bit more philosophical. My only concern, and maybe this is just like a hope that I have, is that we don't allow these lending products. I agree with you that, you know, 2050, 2055, whatever the time frame is, the bright orange future is over some long enough time horizon inevitable. What I get concerned with is complacency amongst Bitcoiners, in that they don't push for the medium exchange use case. I agree with you. Like, it doesn't have to be here today. There's a reason why there's kind of this maybe S-curve sort of adoption. But to the extent that we can, at least in our personal lives, begin to push for and promote those things, I think the sooner we can bring forward that bright orange future. And so maybe like a more philosophical concern with the lending products isn't so much that some people wouldn't benefit from them, but rather, well, some people aren't, because they're going to just put in a swimming pool that they just couldn't afford. They lose their job. They've put too much of their Bitcoin up as collateral. Like, they took on more risk because they just didn't understand. And it's, the risk is on the investor, right? Not on the investment. So there's a part of me that's just like, you know, I hear what you're saying. I agree that this is how the wealthy build wealth. As a person with young kids, I also think about like how quickly can I help promote this in my own life? And so it might just be a distinction of, in your own personal life, do the things you're talking about to build wealth, but also do the things I'm talking about to promote, you know, a Bitcoinized future as soon as we can. You know, make payments in Bitcoin when you can, and spend and replace, and like do these other things that are going to have a smaller impact, but maybe magnified over if we can get a lot of people sort of joining in. If does that make sense or resonate at all?
It makes sense. And what I would say, the nuance that I hear you saying, is that, again, there's 8.5 billion people in the world or whatever. And unfortunately, the majority of people will never put the work in to get ahead in life. Like, you look like you're in really good shape. I'm sure that you have a pretty good diet and you work out. Most people
try
don't.
To be.
Most people don't, right? Most people don't read any books. Most people don't listen to any podcasts. And that's the unfortunate fact. Of course, we're both educators. I mean, I've been making, like I said, 100 million views on YouTube. I'm trying to get everybody to wake up. But the reality is, just the masses, you know, they just don't. And so that's number one. And then because of that, we need things to meet people where they are. Right. So Dave Ramsey, he's, in my opinion, his advice is terrible, because all he says is just save, put it all into mutual funds. Save. Never use credit. Never use debt. Just work your way up through life and save in mutual funds. It's terrible, but he's actually right. He's actually right for the majority
of
people.
For the average person.
He's right for the average person. Yeah. It's wrong if you want to get ahead. Right. So it's like the nuance is, there's just different things for different people. So the average person who doesn't want to think about these things, okay, instead of being Dave Ramsey and just put in mutual funds, okay, just buy Bitcoin and just do that. But for somebody who's more motivated and wants to learn and wants to build wealth 500% faster, they can just learn a couple things and learn how to do it safely, you know? And so that's what I would say. So there's different things for different people. But I would want to challenge you on one thing real quick. I got a couple minutes left. I don't want to say challenge, but just push back on one thing that you said. So you talk about bringing forward this bright orange future. And I'm sure that we both agree that on a sound money standard, we can erase a lot of pain, a lot of problems, a lot of societal problems that have been caused by the fiat monetary system. The divorce rate, the incarceration rate, the obesity rate, I mean, like all wars, right? All these things. So we agree on that. But like, so we both want that. But the reality is that what you're sort of advocating for, which is like, you know, put your Bitcoin in cold storage and save it, and then it goes up in value, and then what? And then I have to sell it? And then I give half the money back to the government so they can go fight more wars? Why would I want to do that? So if we want that future, we have to realize that debt is going to be there. There's no future without debt. As a matter of fact, before money, there was debt. We don't have money. Hey, here's a bushel of wheat. Pay me back later, right? And so I think that there is no future without debt. I don't want to sell my Bitcoin and give half of it to the government, so I'll use debt to do that. It's what Jack Mahler's called the hodler's dilemma. So we have this Bitcoin. We don't want to sell it. It's gone up in value. I don't want to sell it. What do I do? And so we can just like leverage a little bit of against it. So I'd say we both want the same thing. We both see how Bitcoin can fix everything, as we say. But we have to realize that there's different people, different places. And ultimately, what we want is for people, true Bitcoiners, to hold that Bitcoin and not give it to the government, not give it back. And debt would be a necessary part of that.
Yeah, I agree. I certainly agree. Couldn't agree more with not giving anything to the government.
Not any more than we have to.
Yeah. And more than we have to. So I think I've heard Larry Lepard, who I think you know well, say...
Yeah, he's my partner.
He's with the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. That's right. He's talked about he sees less debt less used as an instrument in the future for, like, if you're going to invest in a company, more equity ownership and in that because of a sound money standard. Do you disagree with him on that, or is there a nuance maybe that I'm missing in what you were saying?
Well, I mean, obviously, on a debt-based monetary system, everything is based off of debt, right? Yeah. So obviously that incentivizes that, right? And so we have all types of malinvestment, you know, because we're just throwing money everywhere. Money's free, so it's just going into all types of things that should never get investments. So you would think naturally when there's a true cost of capital that people would be much more specific about their capital. So for example, to me, I said, if it doesn't make more than 50%, I won't invest into it. So it's cut my own investing way down. Right. I would agree on some level that we'll have that. But the way I look at it is, you know, in the world, there's like two types of people. We have creators and we have consumers. And a creator's purpose is to create. That's why Warren Buffett worked until he was like 93 years old, even though he had billions of dollars. It's why all billionaires still work today. It's why Elon Musk is still working and why Jeff Bezos is still working, because they're creators. It's not about the money. A consumer mindset is, if I make enough money, I don't have to work anymore. A creator's purpose is not to make money. A creator's purpose is to create. And the reason why I say that is because there's always going to be people like Buffett who are going to create more than they consume. The consumers consume more than they create, but there's always going to be people that create more than they consume. And once they've created more than they can consume, what do they do with it? They invest it. They give it to other creators to help them. So there's always going to be savings and there's always going to be investments. It's always going to happen. It happened on the gold standard. It's going to continue to happen on the Bitcoin standard. That's credit. But to your point, yes, I think there's going to be less because we'll be much more selective and specific of what we do with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, last very short question for you. I know you're at time, but I always ask this. What's an unpopular opinion that you have? You get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
Well, we spent so much time with it already. I would say the unpopular opinion I have is that Bitcoin treasury companies are actually very, very net positive for the world. And I think they're going to do a really good service. That's one. I would say the other, I guess, one, which we already talked about, I mean, they're just kind of my own personal ones, is again, using debt against Bitcoin is not just something that we can do that's powerful, but it's important and it has to be done so we can keep that Bitcoin away from other people.
To just use it wisely, buy assets, not
liabilities. Yeah, I mean, it's fire, right? I use fire to cook my food, and if I don't control fire properly, I burn my house down. Kids shouldn't play with fire. You said you're a father. Kids shouldn't play with fire because they don't know how to control it, but you use fire, right? And so we should learn how to use credit properly, and that's just up to everybody.
All righty. Mark, this has been fun. Thank you so much. I'm going to have you back because I feel like it's unfinished business here. We got a lot more we could cover, but thank you so much for taking time.
Yeah, for sure. We could probably go another hour easy.
Awesome. Well, you take care. Have a good one. We'll talk.
Okay, thanks.
And that's a wrap again. Hope you enjoyed this conversation. Do me a favor. Let me know what you think. Leave a comment. I'd be fascinated to know how people receive this sort of message, because some of what Mark said, I think, makes obviously a lot of practical sense, but there's a lot of controversy around this in the Bitcoin space. So leave us a comment. If you thought this was interesting, share it with someone. I would really appreciate it. Go check out Mark. Give him a follow. Very fascinating guy, very smart. And of course, if you need help getting your Bitcoin into proper self-custody, 100% self-custody done the right way, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We would love to walk you through how we can assist. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option as well. Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. can follow us on X at the Bitcoin Way _, and you can follow me there as well at the other M Jordan. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.